The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this is our second week of a five-week series on the precepts, the ethical guidelines for our conduct. So I'd just like to start by checking in with you. I know many of you were here last week, so I wanted to just check in and see, first of all, if there were any comments, questions about anything that came up last week around the first precept to refrain from killing living beings, or anything that I talked about generally about precepts. And I'd also like to see perhaps if anybody's interested in sharing anything that they noticed about working with that precept during the week, if there was anything that anybody particularly was interested in sharing around that.
I hope nobody found it difficult.
I find it difficult. Yes.
Well, I had a couple of difficulties with it. One was just a gut reaction. A little red mite crawled across my desk, and before I realized it, I had smashed it. But as soon as I did it, I realized that that's what I had done. And the other one was that I had discovered that a lot of snails were eating a particular plant in my yard, and so at that time I knew I wasn't going to kill them, but I started taking them and putting them in a bucket, and my husband really wanted to kill them. And, you know, I said, I'm not doing it. I don't know about next week. And so we sort of went back and forth. But what it made me think about, I ended up putting them somewhere else, not letting him kill them. But it did bring me back to this question I had last time I talked to you afterwards about meat eating and about letting others do the killing for you.
Mm-hmm.
And how that works, and how, you know, I know you're probably going to say something about the intentions behind it, but I just thought that would be an important topic to bring up.
Yeah, that's one that I wanted to bring up, and if it hadn't come up in the questions, I would have brought it up, because it did come up with several of you afterwards, this question around eating meat. And I just want to talk first from the standpoint of what the Buddhist texts actually say about it first, and then talk about it more generally. So in the time of the Buddha, it's actually, this question was alive and well in the time of the Buddha. In fact, it nearly created a split in the Sangha over this issue. The Buddha's cousin came to him and said, "I really think we ought to not eat meat. You know, it's not a good thing to be eating meat, and I don't think we should accept meat as an offering." And the Buddha refused to accept that. He refused to go along with that. And, you know, I don't know exactly that it's explained so much why he refused, but my understanding of it from my various teachers is that in terms of monks accepting offerings from lay people, he didn't want to limit what lay people could offer to the monks. That it would be a limitation on what they could offer if they could not offer meat. Because often they were eating meat in their household, so they prepare a meal with meat in it. And if they can't offer what they've prepared for themselves, then they may not be able to offer anything. And the Buddha didn't want to put that kind of a limitation on the lay people making their offerings. So that was why he decided to not cut out meat from the monk's diet. On the other hand, he did say to the monks that if you know that meat has been killed particularly for you, you should not accept it. So if the intention behind the killing was to feed this particular monk, they should refuse the meat. So that's kind of the canonical textual context of this question. So Buddhists are not necessarily vegetarian. When I go to Burma, to practice in Burma, they offer meat in their meals. And in fact, I think it's mostly since a lot of Westerners and foreigners have started coming to Burma that they started offering vegetarian options for the people in the monasteries. I know that in Tibet they're not vegetarian. And if you look at the climate in Tibet, if you look at what's possible in Tibet, there's not a lot of growing land, so they eat meat. So they're, you know, Buddhists as a rule throughout the world are not necessarily vegetarian. So you can feel okay about eating meat in terms of this precept, in terms of the strict guidelines of the precept. It is not saying that you can't eat meat. It is saying that you can't kill. And so the question comes up, as you raise, that, well, what do we do about letting other people kill for us? And this is a gray area for this exploration, to look at how we feel about that. And in this culture, we very well know the law of supply and demand. You know, if we restrict or reduce our demand for meat, fewer animals will be killed. So, you know, that's a way in which we can look at this or explore this for ourselves. But again, this is something that we each need to explore for ourselves, to look at our intention behind it. I know some people, I think body types are really different. You know, if you're coming from a stock from, you know, the higher European area where there's not a lot of vegetables that can be grown, our bodies are more designed for meat consumption, and that it's easier for our bodies if there is some meat. Other people do better on vegetables. So, you know, really looking at how our bodies function, how how we feel about it as well. I know that Christopher Titmus says, "I'd rather have the ease of mind than the ease of body." So he's a vegetarian, and perhaps his body would be more comfortable as a meat eater, but he chooses that he's happier with not eating meat for his mental, for the sake of his mind. So this is something we really each need to look at ourselves. You know, I've explored it myself, and I do eat meat, and I went through a period of not eating meat and only eating meat if it was offered to me. Like if I went to my parents' house, my parents are not vegetarian, and I didn't want to make my mother have to prepare a whole separate meal, so I would eat meat when I went there. And I found that my body is happier having meat occasionally, so I do eat meat. But it is something that we each need to look at for ourselves. And I just want to check in and see how people feel about this, because this can sometimes be an interesting or hot topic. So, yeah.
I think the number one issue in regards to this particular topic is a lack of consciousness when we're eating in general. And so we have this tendency to just keep consuming because we're hungry, but we're not really paying attention to what we're consuming and how much of it we're consuming. So in regards to the meat issue, I work in the nutrition industry, and I believe that if we were a little more conscious about the amount of meat that we were consuming, you know, we don't need as much as, you know, most people are doing meat with every single meal, and it's just not necessary. And people, you know, most people don't realize that. We don't look for alternatives.
Yes. And also, I think what you say about it really, again, highlights the intention to look at what we're eating, what we're consuming, how much we're consuming. We consume a tremendous amount in this culture. So really looking at that, and that actually feeds into this taking what is not given to some extent. I mean, again, it's like overconsumption of resources can be seen as a little bit of, you know, essentially taking what's not really offered to us. But that's, again, that's pushing the boundaries. It's really pushing the boundaries of the precept. And I want to be really clear. I mean, I like to explore the edges. And I think it's really important for us, particularly to look at our intention as we are engaging in our day and in the way we deal with our resources. But, you know, just in terms of the precepts themselves, just to be sure that people know that, you know, the precepts are meant to be guidelines that can be achieved, that can actually be worked with. So they're pretty clear cut. They're pretty simple and straightforward. And, taking it so that, you know, we're not over-consuming resources as a part of the second precept makes that precept nearly impossible to achieve. You know, just because we live in this culture, we overconsume. So it's very useful for us to explore it in our intention to, you know, perhaps buy cars that consume less fuel, or to try to telecommute with our jobs to use less fuel as we go around our day, or, you know, things like that, to really look at our intention around using resources, consuming meat. Yeah.
I recently read a couple of articles on meat eaters, and it related it to our blood types, the biological basis for what we eat. And what I read, it said basically that the oldest blood type we have is the O blood type, and O blood type people eat meat. And AB types are more agrarian. This is based on our ancestry. So I had a friend over the other day, and he's a meat eater. I said, "You have old blood type?" "I'm veteran," he said.
I have heard that same thing. Yes.
Is it okay for me to bring that in topic?
Is it around the discussion? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Can is it? Is the red light showing?
Yeah, the red light. Okay. Okay. So my experience this week, on Friday, I was doing pretty well with the ants crawling across my desk, and I also found a rat in my garage. So, and I was able to say, okay, I'm going to wait a week before I make a decision about how I get rid of that rat, so in which kind of trap I'm going to go and get. I was pretty good. And then by Saturday morning, I realized that I would have this week probably to put my dog to sleep, because I have a geriatric dog who's been very sick for about a year and a half and who's been degenerating slowly over the last year and a half. And so it's like an old parent. So, I mean, you just care. You want this person, this pet, to be around as long as you can keep. But it's a lot of work, and at some point it becomes a quality of life issue. And so you try to delay the decision about when to put the dog to sleep as much as possible. And I thought, my God, of all week, it has to be this week that I'm going to put my dog to sleep. And by Tuesday, she was not even able to walk, and I had to pull her up 30, 40 times a day. So I finally went to the vet and did it. But I think for me, it really brought the question of euthanasia at large, and not only for animals, but also for humans, and how far you go with care in hospital, and how long do you pursue maintaining somebody or a pet alive?
Right. Yeah, that's a huge question, a huge issue, and I know many, many people have faced this around pets. And again, I really think this is a personal issue that we really need to confront ourselves, each person. Around euthanasia for parents, you know, hopefully our parents have communicated their wishes to us. I mean, that we as people at least have the option of being able to communicate what we wish around this issue. So, you know, that again is an individual thing for the person, for the people who are taking care of the person. And it's a huge, huge difficulty. I mean, it's a huge conundrum for some people. So, I myself found when my cat was very ill that I just couldn't do it. I couldn't take her to the vet to have her put to sleep. I just couldn't do it. And I actually felt a little bad because I felt like, you know, oh, you know, she's really suffering and, you know, but I just couldn't do it for some reason. I just couldn't do it. So again, you know, it's an individual thing. You know, I had another cat that I had to let my parents take care of at the end of her life because I was in Burma at the end of her life and she had cancer and I knew she might die while I was gone. And I told my mother, you know, you need to make the decision yourself. So, you know, it really is an individual thing, especially around pets. We don't actually have the option to let our pets really tell us what they want. But I was actually shocked with my cat, the one that I couldn't put to sleep. You know, that the experience I had when she died was quite amazing because, you know, she hadn't moved for days. She was sitting in this one place and hadn't moved for days. And I woke up one morning with hearing a noise and she got up and she jumped on my bed and lay down next to me and died. And I was blown away. You know, it's like she was saying goodbye to me. And in that moment I felt like something in me had made the right decision around it. You know, so I think we need to trust our own intuition around it. And, you know, you trusted your intuition around what needed to happen for your animal. And, you know, I think we just need to trust that. And this is the last one. We should go on to the next topic.
I'll try to be brief. So I guess around this area where we're talking about life and death, it's to keep in mind the impermanence of everything, the aspect of old age, sickness, and death, the aspect of to relieve suffering when you see it. I guess if you can see that and get yourself out of the way of what you may be clinging to or what you would like other than what might be. I mean, I think that's the main trick of Buddhism. That would be the optimum thing. But it occurs to me that the precept of not to kill would be to aim at, especially back then, individuals. I mean, what sort of delusion would you be under to take another person's life? Or so I sort of see it as that's the big one.
Yeah, essentially looking at the delusion and also to look at again the intention. So in considering for instance euthanasia, looking at how much of the process is around your own difficulty being with your animal, your own aversion to the process, and how much of it is compassion for relieving suffering. You know, so, you know, we can have a mixture of those two things coming in. And delusion also can play a role. So I'd like to move on. So I'd like to first just to talk a little bit about, again, some general issues around ethics and ethical behavior. Things I didn't cover last week. And the first part is, what are the benefits? What are the benefits of behaving ethically? There are two major benefits that are spoken of. The first one relates to how our ethical conduct affects other people. And the second one relates to how our ethical conduct impacts us. So the first one is, it's said to be that when we behave ethically, we offer the gift of fearlessness to all beings. So what this means is that when somebody is in our presence or a being is in our presence, because we behave ethically, they sense that, or they know that they are safe in our presence. So that we offer that gift to all beings when we behave ethically. And that's a beautiful way to look at this. That it's not simply, you know, right and wrong. It's offering a gift. It's an act of generosity to the beings around us to behave peacefully, ethically, in a way that conduces towards harmony in our relationships. And it's interesting, you know, just a simple example of this, two simple examples of this. At two retreat centers that I go to, at Spirit Rock up in Northern California, just north of San Francisco, the animals there are so unafraid of the people who are on the retreat. The deer will come right up, you know, they'll come within a few feet of you. It's not that they're being fed. I mean, they're not being fed there, so but they just know that they are safe. They know that they're safe on that property. Even the birds I see, you know, the birds on the ground, the little ground birds that run around. When I walk up the path, the little birds on the ground do a little couple hops away from me as I walk up the path. You know, they don't fly off. It's really quite amazing. And the turkeys, you know, the wild turkeys there will do the full mating ritual right in front of the dining room. And, you know, 10 yogis are sitting there staring at them while they're doing this. So, you know, there's a sense of that fearlessness that Spirit Rock has been there for 10 years. And in the course of 10 years, the generations of animals have learned that they're safe in that land. So that's the gift of fearlessness. A slightly different example is it does involve feeding at IMS in Massachusetts, another retreat center. You can go out with a handful of sunflower seeds into the forest, and the chickadees will land on your hand and feed from your hand. It's just it's really an amazing experience to sit there and they pick up a seed and they fly off. But they queue up, you know, it's like there's about 10 of them up there, and they take turns diving down, landing on the hand, picking up a seed and flying off. And it's been, you know, 30 years of that knowing that they're safe. And you don't even actually have to have anything in your hand. I've occasionally gone out and just held my hand out and had them land on my hand because they know. Or I was doing walking meditation once with my hands behind my back, and one of them came and landed in my hand behind my back. So that peacefulness, that non-harming, even the animals sense it. They know that they are safe. So that gift of fearlessness that we offer by behaving in an ethical way. The other aspect that rebounds on us more is when we behave ethically, it's said that we achieve or gain. We gain the bliss of blamelessness, freedom from remorse, essentially. That when we behave ethically, we know that there's no reason for us to feel remorse. There's an example of this around the Dalai Lama. And again, this comes back to intention, really, because, you know, things that we do, we can't really control what happens in the world, and there can be things that we do that cause harm, even though we don't intend them to cause harm. And, you know, the Dalai Lama was asked at one point how he felt about some of his monks being murdered because his refusal to you know, to engage in, you know, combat, basically, with the Chinese. And, you know, he said, paraphrasing what he said, you know, I don't always know if I've made the right decision, but I, you know, I cannot condone any form of violence. And my pure intention is my refuge. So that even though his actions did result in the death of some of his monks, he can take refuge in the fact that he's following these ethical guidelines. And there's a teaching in the Buddhist texts that say that this freedom from remorse is actually the first step on the path. There's a set of steps that take us from virtuous conduct all the way up to complete freedom of mind. So I'll just read this to you. It's pretty brief. Ananda asks the Buddha, "What is the reward and blessing of wholesome morality?" And the Buddha responds, "Freedom from remorse, Ananda." "And what is the blessing and reward of freedom from remorse?" "Joy, Ananda." "And of joy?" "Rapture, Ananda." "And of rapture?" "Tranquility, Ananda." "And of tranquility?" "Happiness, Ananda." "And of happiness?" "Concentration, Ananda." "And of concentration?" "Vision and knowledge according to reality," which means basically seeing things as they are. "And of the vision and knowledge according to reality?" "Turning away and detachment, letting go of clinging." "And of turning away and detachment?" "The vision and knowledge with regard to deliverance, full liberation of mind." So this freedom from remorse through ethical conduct is the first step in a series of steps that leads us through happiness, tranquility, concentration, seeing things as they are, really deeply knowing the truth of reality. Last week, I also talked a little bit about inner and outer virtue, the inner virtue being the qualities of mind that are ethical, the honesty, contentment, truthfulness, compassion, all those qualities that arise out of ethical conduct. And the outer form of ethics is the outer manifestation of those qualities, and also the following the rules of conduct, following these ethical guidelines. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how these two interact, this inner and outer aspects. So most of us have some degree of inner virtue. You know, we're not that far from that inner virtue, but we get swept away from it, and our actions don't always reflect the inner virtue that we do possess. We get swept away from it by greed, by delusion, by anger. So at the beginning, we need some help, because we can get swept away from our, you know, a lot of us have ideals of ethical conduct and do have some ethical qualities, but we do get swept away by these visitors of greed, aversion, and delusion. So it's helpful to have these guidelines, these training rules, essentially, that help us from getting swept away. So there's an interrelationship between the inner qualities of virtue and the outer manifestation. Most of us understand the direction where we have an inner quality of virtue and it results in a behavior, an ethical behavior. And that tends to be the way we think, that if we are internally ethical, internally virtuous, then we will behave virtuously. So if our minds are peaceful, we behave peacefully. And when our minds are angry, sometimes we behave in an angry fashion. So that tends to be the way we think about that interrelationship between our actions and our mental qualities. But this relationship goes both directions. So the way that we behave can also influence or rebound onto our mind. Now, we tend to not trust this as much, or we tend to feel like we're being duplicitous or not true to ourselves if we are behaving in a way that doesn't reflect what we're actually feeling in the moment. We tend to think that, you know, if I'm angry, that what's truest is to express or behave in an angry fashion. Somehow we think in order to behave ethically, we first have to have the internal ethical qualities before we express them with our behavior. But when we understand how the inner and outer relate, we can take advantage of that, and actually, as we behave in an ethical way, it rebounds on our minds and actually tends to cultivate ethical qualities of mind. So behaving peacefully, behaving honestly, behaving compassionately cultivates those things inwardly. If we, as we behave in those ways, if we also aspire to those qualities. I mean, we can't pretend that we have those qualities and, you know, ignore all of the difficulties, ignore all of the anger and all of the delusion and all of the greed. We can't ignore that and pretend like we are really peaceful and content. But we can behave peacefully, contentedly, truthfully. We can make that choice. And that intention of that choice rebounds on our mind and cultivates that quality. So I gave an example last week, I'll just remind you about that, when I was working with the ants in my kitchen and not killing the ants and corralling them with soap. And I found as time went on with this process that I developed a compassion for these ants that I didn't actually know was possible. That the behavior of not killing the ants actually rebounded on the mind and induced that quality of compassion to arise. So even if you're not feeling peaceful or feeling compassionate, if you can arouse the intention or the motivation to behave that way, it will support the cultivation of those qualities. So if you want to be peaceful, behave peacefully. So that intention, that aspect of intention that we've been talking about, is really crucial. You know, that's why it's so important to not simply take these precepts as guidelines to just say, okay, I'm going to do this and not do that, as just blindly following these rules. Because if we're just blindly following the rules, we're not really engaging with that intention to cultivate these qualities. And it's that intention that's so crucial in our cultivation of these wholesome, beautiful qualities of mind. And also another aspect of intention is that it can sometimes be clouded by delusion. That, again, in the beginning, it's not necessarily enough to simply have the intention of goodwill, because we're often deluded about what something would actually be beneficial. There's a saying that I'm sure you're all familiar with: the road to hell is paved with good intentions. that kind of reflects this, that, you know, those good intentions can be clouded by delusion. So, you know, it's not that you would be breaking the precepts if you have good intention and end up causing harm. But there are ways that we can learn when we cause harm, you know, that, oh, maybe I need to change the way I'm behaving. There's an excellent story about this. A naturalist tells this story, David Brower, the founder of the John Muir Institute, tells this story of one of his earliest adventures as a naturalist. At the age of 11, he collected some eggs of the western swallowtail butterfly and kept an eye on them as they hatched into caterpillars, which later turned into chrysalides. Finally, the first of the chrysalides began to crack open, and what Brower saw was this. The emerging butterfly struggled out, its abdomen distended by some sort of fluid that was pumped out over its wings as it hung upside down on a twig. Half an hour later, it was ready to fly, and it took off. As the other chrysalides began to crack open, however, Brower decided to make himself useful. He gently eased open the crack to facilitate the butterfly's emergence, and they promptly slid out, walked around, and one by one dropped dead. He had failed to realize that the exertions he had spared the butterflies was essential to their survival, because they triggered the flow of fluid that had to reach their wings. This experience taught him a lesson he was still talking about 70 years later. What appears to be kind and is meant to be kind can be the reverse of kind. So we really do need to learn from our experience when we notice, and he did instantly learn from his experience and carried this lesson through the rest of his life, that we really do need to be careful. Even in our kindness, we need to take care. So I'd just like to finish this part of the discussion by reminding you that while the precepts are worded negatively, refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from false speech, refraining from intoxicants, that the act of engaging in these training rules rebounds on our minds and cultivates really beautiful, wholesome, positive qualities of mind. So even though they're phrased negatively, they have this function of creating beautiful, positive qualities in our experience. So I'd just like to see if there's any thoughts or comments or questions about any of this that I've just talked about. Okay. So the second precept, talking a little bit about the second precept now, which is refraining from taking what is not given. So this precept is, again, it can be looked at in the very limited way of just what it means to follow the precept or follow the guidelines, the training guidelines, and then we can expand it more. And I'll do both. I'll talk about both sides of it, because we do. It's interesting to explore the edges of the qualities that are cultivated. So this refraining from taking what is not given, the commentaries talk about there needing to be the intention to steal in order for the precept to be violated. So if you accidentally take something, that's not considered stealing. So that intention to steal has to be in place in order for this precept to be broken. The other thing it says is the thing taken has to belong to somebody. So, I mean, that, I guess, is technical definition of stealing. But, you know, again, the if you look at the intention to steal, I thinking back on my experience, I remember when I arrived in California in 1980, I was walking through my neighborhood and there were all of these beautiful wildflowers growing along the street. And I picked a whole bunch of them. And it was several weeks later or days later that I realized, oh, actually, those were in people's yards. You know, I had thought about it being right on the edge of the street, you know, and that kind of being public land. But then I realized, you know, as I looked at various people's houses, that no, you know, that part of the property people had planted things on, and some people had just happened to plant wildflowers on them. And when I realized that they belonged to somebody, I stopped doing that. You know, that there was, initially there was not the perception that this belonged to somebody. But then when the perception came that it actually, oh no, this actually belongs to somebody, then I realized I shouldn't take these. I shouldn't pick these flowers. So there's a lot of gradations to this. Like in the refraining from killing, there's many, many levels of the stealing and different levels of what you might call ethical rebound, depending on what, how this precept is broken. So, you know, it's more ethically inappropriate to take very valuable things than to take things of little value. The other interesting part about this in the commentaries, and, you know, this is something that doesn't necessarily jibe that well with our own culture necessarily, but it is said that it's more ethically inappropriate to take things from people who are very ethically realized. So people who are very ethical, it's a greater, it rebounds more on us to take things from people who have highly developed ethical sensibilities. So stealing something from the Dalai Lama, for instance, is not good, right? Not good. So that you know, that's, again, you know, I'm just conveying to you what is taught, classically taught. So, you know, to me it seems like, you know, it seems pretty equal, you know, whether you're taking something from somebody who has highly developed ethics or not. It's not a good thing. So, but again, I'm just teaching, giving you the classical. So these teachings or these gradations reflect the understanding, again, that the behavior, if we break this precept, it rebounds on our mind, much as following the precept rebounds on our mind. If we engage in that kind of behavior, we end up with a lot of, with the remorse, basically. We can end up with the remorse around what we've done. And then our minds don't settle. So in that, following that list of steps from freedom from remorse, moving on, freedom from remorse leading to joy, rapture, tranquility, happiness. If we have engaged in breaking these precepts, our minds tend to be agitated, even in small ways. I particularly find when I'm on retreat, when my mind is very, very settled and still, that I get very, very sensitive to very small breaches of these precepts. You know, slight exaggerations to my teachers in interviews, and I beat myself up about it. So, you know, we really do need to learn, again, how to engage in recognizing when we have broken one of these precepts and how to deal with it. And I talked about that some last week, that, you know, beating ourselves up is not such a helpful thing. We really need to let go of remorse, resolve that we will do better in the future, potentially make amends. So, and potentially also, you know, re-engage in the commitment to that precept. Now, this precept can get really subtle. And, you know, thinking about different ways that this precept can be actually broken without, you know, ways in which we wouldn't necessarily think about it. So, for instance, taking supplies from work to use at home, you know, taking pens and pencils or pads of paper. I know I've done that. You know, that, oh, you know, this is, they've got so much of it and I need one at home. You know, that to really think about, well, is it actually considered part of the agreement with your company that you're allowed to take these things and use them at home? You know, to look at that. Or is it actually not offered to you as something to use at home, but only offered for you to use at work? So looking at these subtleties. So using somebody's telephone for a long distance call when you haven't asked their permission, or you know, as an employer, perhaps not compensating your employees at a living wage. So, you know, there's so many different ways to look at this. And again, we really always have to come back to our intention. But again, looking at, are we deluded? I mean, I know that I was engaging in delusion when I was taking the stuff from the office. It's like, oh yeah, you know, I know this is okay. You know, well, I didn't really know it was okay. So, really, again, looking at our intention and checking in to see, are we really clear and not deluded around this behavior? So expanding on this exploration beyond the boundaries of the actual precept, Thich Nhat Hanh has expressions of these precepts that do go beyond the actual boundaries. But these are very interesting to look at, to explore. And here's his statement of the second precept. Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I vow to cultivate loving kindness and learn ways to work for the well-being of people, animal, and plants. I vow to practice generosity by sharing my time, energy, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal and not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others, and I will do everything in my power to prevent others from human suffering, of other species. I think that must be phrased wrong. I don't quite understand that last sentence. So we can look at racial injustice, social injustice, economic injustice, any form of injustice as taking what is not given. Historically, racial injustice, beginning with taking the freedom of African Americans as we made them into slaves, or taking the land of Native Americans, or incarcerating Asian Americans in World War II, taking their freedom, taking what is not given. All forms of social injustice are a form of taking what is not given. So are we engaging in social injustice? And can we look at our own complicity in that area? Now again, this is stretching the boundaries of the precept, but really, are we blind and deluded around how we are being complicit with forms of injustice? So again, in working with this precept, and in working with all of the precepts, looking at them as being ways to help us wake up, especially in our daily lives, ways to help us remember to pay attention, cultivating mindfulness, wisdom, energy, patience, all of these qualities as we engage in practicing these precepts. The mindfulness of remembering that we're working with these precepts. The wisdom to begin to look at what is ethical conduct and what is unskillful, what is skillful and what is unskillful behavior. That's actually the definition of wisdom, is knowing what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. The cultivation of patience, because we know we're not going to be perfect. We really have to be patient with ourselves around cultivating these qualities. And the energy that it takes to engage. So, in this coming week, if you would like to engage in this, you know, look at both the actual aspects of the precept, the, you know, not taking what is not offered in the strict sense of the precept, and in the broader sense of, are there ways that we're complicitly engaging in social injustice? So this precept cultivates honesty and contentment. And it's helpful to reflect on this as we're engaging in working with this precept. Again, that helps us to not engage in it just in a, well, I'm not going to steal this week. You know, I'm not going to do this. I'm just not going to take anything from work. I'm not going to make a long distance call at work to my mom, you know, whatever. We're going to just, you know, looking at it. If we're just following it in a kind of cut and dried way, we really lose out on the benefit of engaging in the intention to cultivate the honesty and the contentment. So as you look at it this week, also notice that this is supporting the cultivation of those qualities. And that will actually help it rebounds a little more strongly if we're actually conscious of that quality being cultivated as we engage in working with the precept. So are there any thoughts or comments or questions about this precept? Yeah.
A couple things, I guess. Well, it seems to me that the precept, not taking what it's not given, you can't really get away from the subtleties, the outlying in this complex society. I think possibly back in the day when one lived in the village and didn't venture too far out, you would naturally, those things were very immediate. You didn't know the repercussions of one's actions or the karma might have been let loose by purchasing the decision. They didn't have sweatshops and somewhere else. But I also enjoy the gross aspects of the precepts of, yeah, don't kill. But then the implications of what that means as far as the things that you support or...
Yes.
Which you engage in tangentially. So you can get much more subtle into that. But the initial one, don't kill, don't steal. I guess you can steal if they're dumber than you, is that?
If they're what?
If they're less evolved than you.
No. It's still considered stealing. It's just not as morally culpable.
I'm glad I got that straight.
No, you're right. I mean, we do, especially in this culture, we know so much. We have so much knowledge and information, and we're given so much information, like you say, about sweatshops, for instance, you know, that are buying this T-shirt actually, you know, supports the oppression of people in other countries. You know, we really do need to think about that. But I do want to, you know, just make sure that people aren't, you know, there's a way in which if we take it all on, if we take it all on as I have to follow these as rules, there's like almost no way to do it. So, you know, that's where I'm trying to draw the distinction between the two. You know, that there are some clear-cut guidelines to work with, and then we do need to think about all of the gray areas and all of the ramifications, the global ramifications of our actions. I mean, the chaos theory says if a butterfly flutters its wings, you know, it may impact the monsoons in Tibet. So, you know, our actions can have massive ramifications, but we may not know about them. So really, it comes back to our intention and trying to uncover delusion as much as possible. To not act in a deluded way. Thank you.
I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on the
idea of stealing time.
Yeah, that's another one of those gray areas. Taking time. I have there some other things maybe mentioned. That was one I had written down. I forgot to mention it. Yeah, that's an area. You know, like if we're engaging with somebody when they're not necessarily wanting us to engage, you know, that's a form of taking their time when it's not offered. So yeah, that's another one of those subtle areas, one of that, you know, the realm of the outer lying areas to look at. And I know that I myself sometimes feel a little resentful if somebody, you know, doesn't notice. You know, they're talking and talking and talking and they don't notice that that maybe it's not quite the right time to be engaging in that way. So, you know, it's something again to pay attention to, especially in our own behavior, to take care as we engage with other people's time. So thank you for bringing that up. That's a good more subtle area to look at. Actually, it's 9:00, so we should stop. So thank you all for your attention.